when we got to an aesthetically refined prototype, Dowell remembers. We were behind the glass saying, there isn't going to be an aesthetically refined prototype. Put yourself for a moment in Herman Miller's shoes. You have committed yourself to a brand new product. You have spent an enormous amount of money retooling your furniture factory, and still more making sure that, say, the mesh on the Aeron doesn't pinch the behinds of people who sit on it. But now you find out that people don't like the mesh. In fact, they think the whole chair is ugly. And if there is one thing you know from years and years in the business, it is that people don't buy chairs they think are ugly. So what do you do? You could scrap the chair entirely. You could go back and cover it in a nice, familiar layer of foam. Or you could trust your instincts and dive ahead. Herman Miller took the third course. They went ahead. And what happened? In the beginning, not much. The Aeron, after all, was ugly. Before long, however, the chair started to attract the attention of some of the very cutting-edge elements of the design community. It won a Design of the Decade Award from the Industrial Designers Society of America. In California and New York, in the advertising world and in Silicon Valley, it became a kind of cult object that matched the stripped-down aesthetic of the new economy. It began to appear in films and television commercials, and from there its profile built and grew and blossomed. By the end of the 1990s, sales were growing 50 to 70% annually, and the people at Herman Miller suddenly realized that what they had on their hands was the best-selling chair in the history of the company. Before long, there was no office chair as widely imitated as the Aeron. Everyone wanted to make a chair that looked like the exoskeleton of a giant prehistoric insect. And what are the aesthetic scores today? The Aeron is now an 8. What once was ugly has become beautiful. In the case of a blind sip test, first impressions don't work because colas aren't supposed to be sipped blind. The blind sip test is the wrong context for thin slicing Coke. With the Aeron, the effort to collect consumers' first impressions failed for a slightly different reason. The people reporting their first impressions misinterpreted their own feelings. They said they hated it, but what they really meant was that the chair was so new and unusual that they weren't used to it. This isn't true of everything we call ugly. The Edsel, the Ford Motor Company's famous flop from the 1950s, failed because people thought it looked funny. But 2 or 3 years later, every other car maker didn't suddenly start making cars that looked like the Edsel, the way everyone started copying the Aeron. The Edsel started out ugly, and it's still ugly. By the same token, there are movies that people hate when they see them for the first time, and they still hate them 2 or 3 years later. A bad movie is always a bad movie. The problem is that buried among the things that we hate is a class of products that are in that category only because they are weird. They make us nervous. They are sufficiently different that it takes us some time to understand that we actually like them. When you're in the product development world, you become immersed in your own stuff, and it's hard to keep in mind the fact that the customers you go out and see spend very little time with your product, says Dowell. They know the experience of it then and there, but they don't have any history with it, and it's hard for them to imagine a future with it, especially if it's something very different. That was the thing with the Aeron chair. Office chairs in people's minds had a certain aesthetic. They were cushioned and upholstered. The Aeron chair, of course, isn't. It looked different. There was nothing familiar about it. Maybe the word ugly was just a proxy for different. The problem with market research is that often it is simply too blunt an instrument to pick up this distinction between the bad and the merely different. In the late 1960s, the screenwriter Norman Lear produced a television sitcom pilot for a show called All in the Family. It was a radical departure from the kind of fare then on television. It was edgy and political, and it tackled social issues that the television of the day avoided. Lear took it to ABC. They had it market-tested before 400 carefully selected viewers at a theater in Hollywood. Viewers filled out questionnaires and turned a dial marked very dull, dull, fair, good, and very good as they watch the show, with their responses then translated into a score between 1 and 100. For a drama, a good score was one in the high 60s. For a comedy, the mid-70s. All in the Family scored in the low 40s. ABC said no. Lear took the show to CBS. They ran it through their own market research protocol called the Program Analyzer, which required audiences to push red and green buttons, recording their impressions of the shows they were watching. The results were unimpressive. The recommendation of the research department was that Archie Bunker be rewritten as a soft-spoken and nurturing father. CBS didn't even bother promoting All in the Family before its first season. What was the point? The only reason it made it to the air at all was that the president of the company, Robert Wood, and the head of programming, Fred Silverman, happened to like it, and the network was so dominant at that point that it felt it could afford to take a risk on the show. That same year, CBS was also considering a new comedy show starring Mary Tyler Moore. It, too, was a departure for television. The main character, Mary Richards, was a young, single woman who was interested not in starting a family, as practically every previous television heroine had been, but in advancing her career. CBS ran the first show through the Program Analyzer. The results were devastating. Mary was a loser. Her neighbor, Rhoda Morgenstern, was too abrasive. And another of the major female characters on the show, Phyllis Lindstrom, was seen as not believable. The only reason the Mary Tyler Moore show survived was that by the time CBS tested it, it was already scheduled for broadcast. Had the Mary Tyler Moore show been a mere pilot, such overwhelmingly negative comments would have buried it, Sally Bedell Smith writes in her biography of Silverman, Up the Tube. All in the Family and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, in other words, were the television equivalents of The Air on Chair. Viewers said they hated them, but as quickly became clear when these sitcoms became two of the most successful programs in television history, viewers didn't actually hate them, they were just shocked by them. And all of the ballyhooed techniques used by the armies of market researchers at CBS utterly failed to distinguish between these two very different emotions. Market research isn't always wrong, of course. If All in the Family had been more traditional, and if The Air on had just been a minor variant on the chair that came before it, the act of measuring consumer reactions would not have been nearly as difficult. But testing products or ideas that are truly revolutionary is another matter. And the most successful companies are those that understand that in those cases, the first impressions of their consumers need interpretation. We like market research because it provides certainty, a score, a prediction. If someone asks us why we made the decision we did, we can point to a number. But the truth is that for the most important decisions, there can be no certainty. Kenna did badly when he was subjected to market research. But so what? His music was new and different. And it is the new and different that is always most vulnerable to market research. Section 5. The Gift of Expertise. One bright summer day, I had lunch with two women who run a company in New Jersey called Sensory Spectrum. Their names are Gail Vance Seville and Judy Heilman, and they taste food for a living. If Frito-Lay, for example, has a new kind of tortilla chip, they need to know where their chip prototype fits into the tortilla chip pantheon. How much of a departure is it from their other Doritos varieties? How does it compare to Cape Cod tortilla chips? Do they need to add, say, a bit more salt? Seville and Heilman are the people they send their chips to. Having lunch with professional food tasters, of course, is a tricky proposition. After much thought, I decided on a restaurant called La Madre in downtown Manhattan, which is the kind of place where it takes 5 minutes to recite the list of daily specials. When I arrived, Heilman and Seville were seated, two stylish professional women in business suits. They had already spoken to the waiter. Seville told me the specials from memory. A great deal of thought obviously went into the lunch choices. Heilman settled on pasta, preceded by roasted pumpkin chowder with a sprinkling of celery and onion, finished with creme fraiche and bacon-braised cranberry beans, garnished with diced pumpkin, fried sage, and toasted pumpkin seeds. Seville had a salad, followed by risotto with Prince Edward Island mussels and Manila clams, finished with squid ink. At La Madre, rare is a dish that is not finished in some way or adorned with some kind of reduction. After we ordered, the waiter brought Heilman a spoon for her soup. Seville held up her hand for another. "We share everything," she informed him. "You should see us when we go out with a group of sensory people," Heilman said. "We take our bread plates and pass them around. What you get back is half your meal and a little bit of everyone else's." The soup came. The two of them dug in. "Oh, it's fabulous," Seville said, and cast her eyes heavenward. She handed me her spoon. "Taste it." Heilman and Seville both ate with small, quick bites, and as they ate, they talked, interrupting each other like old friends, jumping from topic to topic. They were very funny and talked very quickly, but the talking never overwhelmed the eating. The opposite was true. They seemed to talk only to heighten their anticipation of the next bite, and when the next bite came, their faces took on a look of utter absorption. Heilman and Seville don't just taste food. They think about food. They dream about food. Having lunch with them is like going cello shopping with Yo-Yo Ma, or dropping in on Giorgio Armani one morning as he's deciding what to wear. "My husband says that living with me is like a taste-a-minute tour," Seville said. "It drives everyone in my family crazy. Stop talking about it. You know that scene in the deli from the movie When Harry Met Sally? That's what I feel about food when it's really good." The waiter came offering dessert, creme brulee, mango and chocolate sorbet, or strawberry saffron and sweet corn vanilla gelato. Heilman had the vanilla gelato and the mango sorbet, but not before she thought hard about the creme brulee. "Creme brulee is the test of any restaurant," she said. "It comes down to the quality of the vanilla. I don't like my creme brulee adulterated, because then you can't taste through to the quality of the ingredients." An espresso came for Seville. As she took her first sip, an almost imperceptible wince crossed her face. "It's good, not great," she said. "It's missing the whole winey texture. It's a little too woody." Heilman then started talking about rework, which is the practice in some food factories of recycling leftover or rejected ingredients from one product batch into another product batch. "Give me some cookies and crackers," she said, "and I can tell you not only what factory they came from, but what rework they were using." Seville jumped in. Just the previous night, she said, she'd eaten two cookies, and here she named two prominent brands. "I could taste the rework," she said, and made another face. "We've spent years and years developing these skills," she went on. 20 years. "It's like medical training. You do your internship, and then you become a resident. And you do it and do it until you can look at something and say in a very objective way how sweet it is, how bitter it is, how caramelized it is, how much citrus character there is. And in terms of the citrus, this much lemon, this much lime, this much grapefruit, this much orange." Heilman and Seville, in other words, are experts. Would they get fooled by the Pepsi challenge? Of course not. Nor would they be led astray by the packaging for Christian Brothers, or be as easily confused by the difference between something they truly don't like and something they simply find unusual. The gift of their expertise is that it allows them to have a much better understanding of what goes on behind the locked door of their unconscious. This is the last and most important lesson of the Kenna story, because it explains why it was such a mistake to favor the results of Kenna's market research so heavily over the enthusiastic reactions of the industry insiders, the crowd at the Roxy, and the viewers of MTV2. The first impressions of experts are different. By that, I don't mean that experts like different things than the rest of us, although that is undeniable. When we become expert in something, our tastes grow more esoteric and complex. What I mean is that it is really only experts who are able to reliably account for their reactions. Jonathan Schuller, whom I introduced in the previous chapter, once did an experiment with Timothy Wilson that beautifully illustrates this difference. It involved strawberry jam. Consumer Reports put together a panel of food experts and had them rank 44 different brands of strawberry jam from top to bottom according to very specific measures of texture and taste. Wilson and Schuller took the 1st, 11th, 24th, 32nd, and 44th ranking jams, Knott's Berry Farm, Alpha Beta, Featherweight, Acme, and Sorrel Ridge, and gave them to a group of college students. Their question was, how close would the students' rankings come to the experts? The answer is, pretty close. The students put Knott's Berry Farm second and Alpha Beta first, reversing the order of the first two jams. The experts and the students both agreed that Featherweight was number 3, and, like the experts, the students thought that Acme and Sorrel Ridge were markedly inferior to the others, although the experts thought Sorrel Ridge was worse than Acme, while the students had the order the other way around. Scientists use something called a correlation to measure how closely one factor predicts another, and overall, the student ratings correlated with the expert ratings by 0.55, which is quite a high correlation. What this says, in other words, is that our jam reactions are quite good. Even those of us who aren't jam experts know good jam when we taste it. But what would happen if I were to give you a questionnaire and ask you to enumerate your reasons for preferring one jam to another? Disaster. Wilson and Schuller had another group of students provide a written explanation for their rankings, and they put Knott's Berry Farm, the best jam of all, according to the experts, second to last, and Sorrel Ridge, the experts' worst jam, third. The overall correlation was now down to 0.11, which for all intents and purposes means that the students' evaluations had almost nothing at all to do with the experts' evaluations. This is reminiscent of Schuller's experiments that I described in the Van Riper story, in which introspection destroyed people's ability to solve insight problems. By making people think about jam, Wilson and Schuller turned them into jam idiots. In the earlier discussion, however, I was referring to things that impair our ability to solve problems. Now I'm talking about the loss of a much more fundamental ability, namely the ability to know our own mind. Furthermore, in this case, we have a much more specific explanation for why introspections mess up our reactions. It's that we simply don't have any way of explaining our feelings about jam. We know unconsciously what good jam is. It's Knott's Berry Farm. But suddenly, we're asked to stipulate, according to a list of terms, why we think that, and the terms are meaningless to us. Texture, for instance. What does that mean? We may never have thought about the texture of any jam before, and we certainly don't understand what texture means, and texture may be something that we actually, on a deep level, don't particularly care much about. But now the idea of texture has been planted in our mind, and we think about it, and we decide that, well, the texture does seem a little strange, and in fact, maybe we don't like this jam after all. As Wilson puts it, what happens is that we come up with a plausible-sounding reason for why we might like or dislike something, and then we adjust our true preference to be in line with that plausible-sounding reason. Jam experts, though, don't have the same problem when it comes to explaining their feelings about jam. Expert food tasters are taught a very specific vocabulary, which allows them to describe precisely their reactions to specific foods. Mayonnaise, for example, is supposed to be evaluated along 6 dimensions of appearance: color, color intensity, chroma, shine, lumpiness, and bubbles. 10 dimensions of texture: adhesiveness to lips, firmness, denseness, and so on. And 14 dimensions of flavor, split among 3 subgroups: aromatics, eggy, mustard, and so forth; basic tastes, salty, sour, and sweet; and chemical feeling factors, burn, pungent, astringent. Each of those factors, in turn, is evaluated on a 15-point scale. So, for example, if we wanted to describe the oral texture of something, one of the attributes we would look at is slipperiness. And on the 15-point slipperiness scale, where 0 is not slippery at all and 15 is very slippery, Gerber's beef and beef gravy baby food is a 2, Whitney's vanilla yogurt is a 7.5, and Miracle Whip is a 13. If you taste something that's not quite as slippery as Miracle Whip, but more slippery than Whitney's vanilla yogurt, then you might give it a 10. Or take crispiness. Quaker's low-fat, chewy, chocolate chunk granola bars are a 2. Keebler Club Partners crackers are a 5. And Kellogg's cornflakes are a 14. Every product in the supermarket can be analyzed along these lines. And after a taster has worked with these scales for years, they become embedded in the taster's unconscious. "We just did Oreos," said Heilman, "and we broke them into 90 attributes of appearance, flavor, and texture." She paused, and I could tell that she was recreating in her mind what an Oreo feels like. It turns out there are 11 attributes that are probably critical. Our unconscious reactions come out of a locked room, and we can't look inside that room. But with experience, we can become expert at using our behavior and our training to interpret and decode what lies behind our snap judgments and first impressions. It's a lot like what people do when they are in psychoanalysis. They spend years analyzing their unconscious with the help of a trained therapist until they begin to get a sense of how their mind works. Heilman and Seville have done the same thing, only they haven't psychoanalyzed their feelings. They've psychoanalyzed their feelings for mayonnaise and Oreo cookies. All experts do this, either formally or informally. Gottman wasn't happy with his instinctive reactions to couples, so he videotaped thousands of men and women, broke down every second of the tapes, and ran the data through a computer. And now he can sit down next to a couple in a restaurant and confidently thin-slice their marriage. Vic Braden, the tennis coach, was frustrated by the fact that he knew when someone was about to double fault, but didn't know how he knew. He is now teamed up with some experts in biomechanics who are going to film and digitally analyze professional tennis players in the act of serving so they can figure out precisely what it is in the player's delivery that Braden is unconsciously picking up on. And why was Thomas Hoving so sure in those first 2 seconds that the Geddes Kouros was a fake? Because over the course of his life, he'd experienced countless ancient sculptures and learned to understand and interpret that first impression that crossed his mind. In my second year working at the Met, I had the good luck of having this European curator come over and go through virtually everything with me, he says. We spent evening after evening taking things out of cases and putting them on the table. We were down in the storerooms. There were thousands of things. I mean, we were there every night until 10 o'clock, and it wasn't just a routine glance. It was really poring and poring and poring over things. What he was building in those nights in the storerooms was a kind of database in his unconscious. He was learning how to match the feeling he had about an object with what was formally understood about its style and background and value. Whenever we have something that we are good at, something we care about, that experience and passion fundamentally change the nature of our first impressions. This does not mean that when we are outside our areas of passion and experience, our reactions are invariably wrong. It just means that they are shallow. They are hard to explain and easily disrupted. They aren't grounded in real understanding. Do you think, for example, that you can accurately describe the difference between Coke and Pepsi? It's actually surprisingly difficult. Food tasters like Seville and Heilman use what they call a DOD, degree of difference scale, to compare products in the same category. It goes from 0 to 10, where 10 is for two things that are totally different and one or two might describe just the production range differences between two batches of the same product. Wise and Lay's salt and vinegar potato chips, for instance, have a DOD of 8. Oh my God, they are so different, says Heilman. Wise is dark and Lay's is uniform and light. Things with a DOD of 5 or 6 are much closer, but still possible to tell apart. Coke and Pepsi, though, are only of 4, and in some cases the difference may be even less, particularly if the colas have aged a bit and the level of carbonation has decreased and the vanilla has become a little more pronounced and pruny. This means that if we are asked to give our thoughts on Coke and Pepsi, most of our answers aren't going to be very useful. We can say whether we like it. We can make some vague and general comments about the level of carbonation or flavor or sweetness and sourness. But with a DOD of 4, only someone schooled in colas is going to be able to pick up on the subtle nuances that distinguish each soft drink. I imagine that some of you, particularly those who are die-hard cola drinkers, are bristling at this point. I'm being a bit insulting. You think you really do know your way around Pepsi and Coke. Okay, let's concede that you can reliably tell Coke from Pepsi even when the DOD hovers around 4. In fact, I urge you to test yourself. Have a friend pour Pepsi into one glass and Coke into another and try to tell them apart. Let's say you succeed. Congratulations. Now, let's try the test again in a slightly different form. This time, have your tester give you 3 glasses, 2 of which are filled with one of the colas and the third with the other. In the beverage business, this is called a triangle test. This time around, I don't want you to identify which is Coke and which is Pepsi. All I want you to say is which of the 3 drinks is not like the other 2. Believe it or not, you will find this task incredibly hard. If 1,000 people were to try this test, just over 1/3 would guess right, which is not much better than chance. We might as well just guess. When I first heard about the triangle test, I decided to try it on a group of my friends. None of them got it right. These were all well-educated, thoughtful people, most of whom were regular cola drinkers, and they simply couldn't believe what had happened. They jumped up and down. They accused me of tricking them. They argued that there must have been something funny about the local Pepsi and Coke bottlers. They said that I had manipulated the order of the 3 glasses to make it more difficult for them. None of them wanted to admit the truth. Their knowledge of colas was incredibly shallow. With 2 colas, all we have to do is compare 2 first impressions. But with 3 glasses, we have to be able to describe and hold the taste of the first and then the second cola in our memory, and somehow, however briefly, convert a fleeting sensory sensation into something permanent. And to do that requires knowledge and understanding of the vocabulary of taste. Heilman and Seville can pass the triangle test with flying colors because their knowledge gives their first impressions resiliency. My friends were not so fortunate. They may drink a lot of cola, but they don't ever really think about colas. They aren't cola experts, and to force them to be, to ask too much of them, is to render their reactions useless. Isn't this what happened to Kenna? Section 6. It sucks what the record companies are doing to you. After years of starts and stops, Kenna was finally signed by Columbia Records. He released an album called New Sacred Cow. Then he went on his first tour, playing in 14 cities throughout the American West and Midwest. It was a modest beginning. He opened for another band and played for 35 minutes. Many people in the audience didn't even realize that he was on the bill. But once they heard him play, they were enthusiastic. He also made a video of one of his songs, which was nominated for an award on VH1. College radio stations began playing New Sacred Cow, and it started to climb the college charts. He then got a few appearances on television talk shows. But the big prize still eluded him. His album didn't take off because he couldn't get his first single played on Top 40 radio. It was the same old story. The equivalent of Gail Van Seville and Judy Heilman had loved Kenna. Craig Coleman heard his demo tape and got on the phone and said, "I want to see him now." Fred Durst heard one of his songs over the telephone and decided that this was it. Paul McGuinness flew him to Ireland. The people who had a way to structure their first impressions, the vocabulary to capture them, and the experience to understand them, loved Kenna. And in a perfect world, that would have counted for more than the questionable findings of market research. But the world of radio is not as savvy as the world of food or the furniture makers at Herman Miller. They prefer a system that cannot measure what it promises to measure. I guess they've gone to their focus groups, and the focus groups have said, no, it's not a hit. They don't want to put money into something that doesn't test well, Kenna says. But that's not the way this music works. This music takes faith. And faith isn't what the music business is about anymore. It's absolutely frustrating, and it's overwhelming as well. I can't sleep. My mind is running. But if nothing else, I get to play. And the response from the kids is so massive and beautiful that it makes me get up the next day and fight again. The kids come up to me after the show and say, "It sucks what the record companies are doing to you. But we're here for you, and we're telling everybody." Chapter 6, 7 Seconds in the Bronx, The Delicate Art of Mind Reading. The 1100 block of Wheeler Avenue in the Soundview neighborhood of the South Bronx is a narrow street of modest two-story houses and apartments. At one end is the bustle of Westchester Avenue, the neighborhood's main commercial strip, and from there the block runs about 200 yards, flanked by trees and twin rows of parked cars. The buildings were built in the early part of the last century. Many have an ornate facade of red brick, with 4 or 5 step stoops leading to the front door. It is a poor and working-class neighborhood, and in the late 1990s, the drug trade in the area, particularly on Westchester Avenue and one block over on Elder Avenue, was brisk. Soundview is just the kind of place where you would go if you were an immigrant in New York City who was looking to live somewhere cheap and close to a subway. And that's why Amadou Diallo made his way to Wheeler Avenue. Diallo was from Guinea. In 1999, he was 22 and working as a peddler in Lower Manhattan, selling videotapes and socks and gloves from the sidewalk along 14th Street. He was short and unassuming, about 5'6" and 150 pounds, and he lived at 1157 Wheeler, on the second floor of one of the street's narrow apartment houses. On the night of February 3, 1999, Diallo returned home to his apartment just before midnight, talked to his roommates, and then went downstairs and stood at the top of the steps to his building, taking in the night. A few minutes later, a group of plainclothes police officers turned slowly onto Wheeler Avenue in an unmarked Ford Taurus. There were 4 of them, all white, all wearing jeans and sweatshirts and baseball caps and bulletproof vests, and all carrying police-issue 9mm semi-automatic handguns. They were part of what is called the Street Crime Unit, a special division of the New York City Police Department, dedicated to patrolling crime hotspots in the city's poorest neighborhoods. Driving the Taurus was Ken Boss. He was 27. Next to him was Sean Carroll, 35, and in the back seat were Edward McMillan, 26, and Richard Murphy, 26. It was Carroll who spotted Diallo first. "Hold up, hold up," he said to the others in the car. "What's that guy doing there?" Carroll claimed later that he had two thoughts. One was that Diallo might be the lookout for a push-in robber, that is, a burglar who pretends to be a visitor and pushes his way into people's apartments. The other was that Diallo fitted the description of a serial rapist who had been active in the neighborhood about a year earlier. "He was just standing there," Carroll recalled. "He was just standing on the stoop, looking up and down the block, peeking his head out, and then putting his head back against the wall. Within seconds, he does the same thing, looks down, looks right. And it appeared that he stepped backwards into the vestibule as we were approaching, like he didn't want to be seen. And then we pass by, and I'm looking at him, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. What's this guy up to?" Boss stopped the car and backed up until the Taurus was right in front of 1157 Wheeler. Diallo was still there, which Carroll would later say amazed him. "I'm like, all right, definitely something is going on here." Carroll and McMillan got out of the car. "Police," McMillan called out, holding up his badge. "Can we have a word?" Diallo didn't answer. Later, it emerged that Diallo had a stutter, so he may well have tried to say something but simply couldn't. What's more, his English wasn't perfect, and it was rumored as well that someone he knew had recently been robbed by a group of armed men, so he must have been terrified. Here he was, outside in a bad neighborhood after midnight with two very large men in baseball caps, their chests inflated by their bulletproof vests, striding toward him. Diallo paused and then ran into the vestibule. Carroll and McMillan gave chase. Diallo reached the inside door and grabbed the doorknob with his left hand while, as the officers would later testify, turning his body sideways and digging into his pocket with his other hand. "Show me your hands," Carroll called out. McMillan was yelling too. "Get your hands out of your pockets. Don't make me fucking kill you." But Diallo was growing more and more agitated, and Carroll was starting to get nervous too, because it seemed to him that the reason Diallo was turning his body sideways was that he wanted to hide whatever he was doing with his right hand. "We were probably at the top steps of the vestibule, trying to get to him before he got through that door," Carroll remembered. "The individual turned, looked at us. His hand was still on the doorknob, and he starts removing a black object from his right side. And as he pulled the object, all I could see was a top. It looked like the slide of a black gun. My prior experience and training, my prior arrests, dictated to me that this person was pulling a gun." Carroll yelled out, "Gun! He's got a gun!" Diallo didn't stop. He continued pulling on something in his pocket, and now he began to raise the black object in the direction of the officers. Carroll opened fire. McMillan instinctively jumped backward off the step and landed on his backside, firing as he flew through the air. As his bullets ricocheted around the vestibule, Carroll assumed that they came from Diallo's gun, and when he saw McMillan flying backward, he assumed that McMillan had been shot by Diallo, so he kept shooting, aiming, as police are taught to do, for center mass. There were pieces of cement and splinters of wood flying in every direction, and the air was electric with the flash of gun muzzles and the sparks from the bullets. Boss and Murphy were now out of the car as well, running toward the building. "I saw Ed McMillan," Boss would later testify, when the four officers were brought to trial on charges of first-degree manslaughter and second-degree murder. "He was on the left side of the vestibule and just came flying off that step all the way down. And at the same time, Sean Carroll is on the right-hand side, and he's coming down the stairs. It was frantic. He was running down the stairs, and it was intense. He was just doing whatever he could to retreat off those stairs. And Ed was on the ground. Shots are still going off. I'm running, I'm moving. And Ed was shot. That's all I could see. Ed was firing his weapon. Sean was firing his weapon into the vestibule. And then I see Mr. Diallo. He's in the rear of the vestibule, in the back, towards the back wall, where that inner door is. He's a little bit off to the side of that door, and he's crouched. He is crouched, and he has his hand out, and I see a gun. And I said, 'My God, I'm going to die.' I fired my weapon. I fired it as I was pushing myself backward, and then I jumped off to the left. I was out of the line of fire. His knees were bent, his back was straight up, and what it looked like was somebody trying to make a smaller target. It looked like a combat stance, the same one that I was taught in the police academy. At that point, the attorney questioning boss interrupted. And how was his hand? It was out. Straight out? Straight out. And in his hand you saw an object. Is that correct? Yeah, I thought I saw a gun in his hand. What I seen was an entire weapon, a square weapon in his hand. It looked to me at that split second, after all the gunshots around me and the gun smoke and Ed McMillan down, that he was holding a gun, and that he had just shot Ed and that I was next. Carroll and McMillan fired 16 shots each, an entire clip. Boss fired 5 shots. Murphy fired 4 shots. There was silence. Guns drawn, they climbed the stairs and approached Diallo. I seen his right hand, Boss said later. It was out from his body. His palm was open. And where there should have been a gun, there was a wallet. I said, "Where's the fucking gun?" Boss ran up the street toward Westchester Avenue because he had lost track in the shouting and the shooting of where they were. Later, when the ambulances arrived, he was so distraught he could not speak. Carroll sat down on the steps next to Diallo's bullet-ridden body and started to cry. Section 1. 3 Fatal Mistakes. Perhaps the most common and the most important forms of rapid cognition are the judgments we make and the impressions we form of other people. Every waking minute that we are in the presence of someone, we come up with a constant stream of predictions and inferences about what that person is thinking and feeling. When someone says, "I love you," we look into that person's eyes to judge his or her sincerity. When we meet someone new, we often pick up on subtle signals, so that afterward, even though he or she may have talked in a normal and friendly manner, we may say, "I don't think he liked me," or "I don't think she's very happy." We easily parse complex distinctions in facial expression. If you were to see me grinning, for example, with my eyes twinkling, you'd say I was amused. But if you were to see me nod and smile exaggeratedly, with the corners of my lips tightened, you would take it that I had been teased and was responding sarcastically. If I were to make eye contact with someone, give a small smile, and then look down and avert my gaze, you would think I was flirting. If I were to follow a remark with a quick smile and then nod or tilt my head sideways, you might conclude that I had just said something a little harsh and wanted to take the edge off it. You wouldn't need to hear anything I was saying in order to reach those conclusions. They would just come to you, blink. If you were to approach a 1-year-old child who sits playing on the floor and do something a little bit puzzling, such as cupping your hands over hers, the child would immediately look into your eyes. Why? Because what you have done requires explanation, and the child knows that she can find an answer on your face. This practice of inferring the motivations and intentions of others is classic thin slicing. It is picking up on subtle, fleeting cues in order to read someone's mind, and there is almost no other impulse so basic and so automatic, and at which, most of the time, we so effortlessly excel. In the early hours of February 4, 1999, however, the 4 officers cruising down Wheeler Avenue failed at this most fundamental task. They did not read Diallo's mind. First, Sean Carroll saw Diallo and said to the others in the car, "What's that guy doing there?" The answer was that Diallo was getting some air. But Carroll sized him up and in that instant decided he looked suspicious. That was mistake number 1. Then they backed the car up and Diallo didn't move. Carroll later said that amazed him. How brazen was this man who didn't run at the sight of the police? Diallo wasn't brazen. He was curious. That was mistake number 2. Then Carroll and Murphy stepped toward Diallo on the stoop and watched him turn slightly to the side and make a movement for his pocket. In that split second, they decided he was dangerous. But he was not. He was terrified. That was mistake number three. Ordinarily, we have no difficulty at all distinguishing, in a blink, between someone who is suspicious and someone who is not, between someone brazen and someone curious, and, most easily of all, between someone terrified and someone dangerous. Anyone who walks down a city street late at night makes these kinds of instantaneous calculations constantly. Yet, for some reason, that most basic human ability deserted those officers that night. Why? These kinds of mistakes were not anomalous events. Mind-reading failures happen to all of us. They lie at the root of countless arguments, disagreements, misunderstandings, and hurt feelings. And yet, because these failures are so instantaneous and so mysterious, we don't really know how to understand them. In the weeks and months that followed the Diallo shooting, for example, as the case made headlines around the world, the argument over what happened that night veered back and forth between two extremes. There were those who said that it was just a horrible accident, an inevitable byproduct of the fact that police officers sometimes have to make life-or-death decisions in conditions of uncertainty. That's what the jury in the Diallo trial concluded, and Boss, Carroll, McMillan, and Murphy were all acquitted of murder charges. On the other side were those who saw what happened as an open-and-shut case of racism. There were protests and demonstrations throughout the city. Diallo was held up as a martyr. Wheeler Avenue was renamed Amadou Diallo Place. Bruce Springsteen wrote and performed a song in his honor called 41 Shots. Neither of these explanations, however, is particularly satisfying. There was no evidence that the four officers in the Diallo case were bad people, or racists, or out to get Diallo. On the other hand, it seems wrong to call the shooting a simple accident, since this wasn't exactly exemplary police work. The officers made a series of critical misjudgments, beginning with the assumption that a man getting a breath of fresh air outside his own home was a potential criminal. The Diallo shooting, in other words, falls into a kind of gray area, the middle ground between deliberate and accidental. Mind-reading failures are sometimes like that. They aren't always as obvious and spectacular as other breakdowns in rapid cognition. They are subtle and complex and surprisingly common, and what happened on Wheeler Avenue is a powerful example of how mind-reading works and how it sometimes goes terribly awry. Section 2. The Theory of Mind-Reading. Much of our understanding of mind-reading comes from two remarkable scientists, a teacher and his pupil, Sylvan Tompkins and Paul Ekman. Tompkins was the teacher. He was born in Philadelphia at the turn of the last century, the son of a dentist from Russia. He was short and thick around the middle, with a wild mane of white hair and huge black plastic-rimmed glasses. He taught psychology at Princeton and Rutgers and was the author of Affect Imagery Consciousness, a four-volume work so dense that its readers were evenly divided between those who understood it and thought it was brilliant and those who did not understand it and thought it was brilliant. He was a legendary talker. At the end of a cocktail party, a crowd of people would sit rapt at Tompkins's feet. Someone would say, "One more question," and everyone would stay for another hour and a half as Tompkins held forth on, say, comic books, a television sitcom, the biology of emotion, his problem with Kant, and his enthusiasm for the latest fad diets, all enfolded into one extended riff. During the Depression, in the midst of his doctoral studies at Harvard, he worked as a handicapper for a horse racing syndicate and was so successful that he lived lavishly on Manhattan's Upper East Side. At the track, where he sat in the stands for hours staring at the horses through binoculars, he was known as the professor. He had a system for predicting how a horse would do, based on what horse was on either side of him, based on their emotional relationship, Ekman remembers. If a male horse, for instance, had lost to a mare in his first or second year, he would be ruined if he went to the gate with a mare next to him in the lineup, or something like that. No one really knew for certain. Tompkins believed that faces, Even the faces of horses held valuable clues to inner emotions and motivations. He could walk into a post office, it was said, go over to the wanted posters, and, just by looking at the mugshots, say what crimes the various fugitives had committed. He would watch the show to tell the truth, and, without fail, he could always pick out the people who were lying, his son Mark recalls. He actually wrote the producer at one point to say it was too easy, and the man invited him to come to New York, go backstage, and show his stuff. Virginia Demos, who teaches psychology at Harvard, recalls having long conversations with Tompkins during the 1988 Democratic National Convention. We would sit and talk on the phone, and he would turn the sound down while, say, Jesse Jackson was talking to Michael Dukakis. And he would read the faces and give his predictions on what would happen. It was profound. Paul Ekman first encountered Tompkins in the early 1960s. Ekman was then a young psychologist just out of graduate school, and he was interested in studying faces. Was there a common set of rules, he wondered, that governed the facial expressions that human beings made? Sylvan Tompkins said that there was. But most psychologists said that there wasn't. The conventional wisdom at the time held that expressions were culturally determined. That is, we simply used our faces according to a set of learned social conventions. Ekman didn't know which view was right. So, to help him decide, he traveled to Japan, Brazil, and Argentina, and even to remote tribes in the jungles of the Far East, carrying photographs of men and women making a variety of distinctive faces. To his amazement, everywhere he went, people agreed on what those expressions meant. Tompkins, he realized, was right. Not long afterward, Tompkins visited Ekman at his laboratory in San Francisco. Ekman had tracked down 100,000 feet of film that had been shot by the virologist Carlton Gudusek in the remote jungles of Papua New Guinea. Some of the footage was of a tribe called the South Foray, who were a peaceful and friendly people. The rest was of the Ku-Ku-Ku-Ku, a hostile and murderous tribe with a homosexual ritual in which pre-adolescent boys were required to serve as courtesans for the male elders of the tribe. For 6 months, Ekman and his collaborator, Wallace Friesen, had been sorting through the footage, cutting extraneous scenes, focusing just on the close-ups of the faces of the tribesmen in order to compare the facial expressions of the two groups. Ekman set up the projector. Tompkins waited in the back. He had been told nothing about the tribes involved. All identifying context had been edited out. Tompkins looked on intently, peering through his glasses. At the end of the film, he approached the screen and pointed to the faces of the South Foray. "These are a sweet, gentle people, very indulgent, very peaceful," he said. Then he pointed to the faces of the Ku-Ku-Ku-Ku. "This other group is violent, and there is lots of evidence to suggest homosexuality." Even today, a third of a century later, Ekman cannot get over what Tompkins did. "My God," I vividly remember saying, "Sylvan, how on earth are you doing that?" Ekman recalls. And he went up to the screen, and while we played the film backward in slow motion, he pointed out the particular bulges and wrinkles in the faces that he was using to make his judgment. That's when I realized, I've got to unpack the face. It was a goldmine of information that everyone had ignored. This guy could see it, and if he could see it, maybe everyone else could too. Ekman and Friesen decided, then and there, to create a taxonomy of facial expressions. They combed through medical textbooks that outlined the facial muscles, and they identified every distinct muscular movement that the face could make. There were 43 such movements. Ekman and Friesen called them action units. Then they sat across from each other again, for days on end, and began manipulating each action unit in turn, first locating the muscle in their minds, and then concentrating on isolating it, watching each other closely as they did, checking their movements in a mirror, making notes on how the wrinkle patterns on their faces would change with each muscle movement, and videotaping the movement for their records. On the few occasions when they couldn't make a particular movement, they went next door to the UCSF anatomy department, where a surgeon they knew would stick them with a needle and electrically stimulate the recalcitrant muscle. That wasn't pleasant at all, Ekman recalls. When each of those action units had been mastered, Ekman and Friesen began working action units in combination, layering one movement on top of another. The entire process took 7 years. There are 300 combinations of two muscles, Ekman says. If you add in a third, you get over 4,000. We took it up to 5 muscles, which is over 10,000 visible facial configurations. Most of those 10,000 facial expressions don't mean anything, of course. They are the kind of nonsense faces that children make. But by working through each action unit combination, Ekman and Friesen identified about 3,000 that did seem to mean something, until they had cataloged the essential repertoire of human facial displays of emotion. Paul Ekman is now in his 60s. He is clean-shaven, with closely set eyes and thick, prominent eyebrows, and although he is of medium build, he seems much larger. There is something stubborn and substantial in his demeanor. He grew up in Newark, New Jersey, the son of a pediatrician, and entered the University of Chicago at 15. He speaks deliberately. Before he laughs, he pauses slightly, as if waiting for permission. He is the sort who makes lists and numbers his arguments. His academic writing has an orderly logic to it. By the end of an Ekman essay, each stray objection and problem has been gathered up and cataloged. Since the mid-1960s, he has been working out of a ramshackle Victorian townhouse at the University of California at San Francisco, where he holds a professorship. When I met Ekman, he sat in his office and began running through the action unit configurations he had learned so long ago. He leaned forward slightly, placing his hands on his knees. On the wall behind him were photographs of his two heroes, Tompkins and Charles Darwin. "Everybody can do Action Unit 4," he began. He lowered his brow, using his depressor glabelli, depressor supercilii, and corrugator. "Almost everyone can do AU 9. He wrinkled his nose, using his levator labii superioris aliquai nasi. "Everybody can do 5. He contracted his levator palpebrae superioris, raising his upper eyelid. I was trying to follow along with him, and he looked up at me. "You've got a very good 5, he said generously. "The more deeply set your eyes are, the harder it is to see the 5. "Then there's 7, he squinted. 12, he flashed a smile, activating the zygomatic major. The inner parts of his eyebrows shot up. "That's AU1. Distress, anguish. Then he used his frontalis, pars lateralis, to raise the outer half of his eyebrows. "That's AU2. It's also very hard, but it's worthless. It's not part of anything except kabuki theater. 23 is one of my favorites. It's the narrowing of the red margin of the lips. Very reliable anger sign. It's very hard to do voluntarily." He narrowed his lips. "Moving one ear at a time is still one of the hardest things to do. I have to really concentrate. It takes everything I've got." He laughed. "This is something my daughter always wanted me to do for her friends. Here we go." He wiggled his left ear, then his right ear. Ekman does not appear to have a particularly expressive face. He has the demeanor of a psychoanalyst, watchful and impassive, and his ability to transform his face so easily and quickly was astonishing. "There is one I can't do," he went on. "It's AU-39. Fortunately, one of my postdocs can do it. AU-38 is dilating the nostrils. 39 is the opposite. It's the muscle that pulls them down." He shook his head and looked at me again. "Oh, you've got a fantastic 39. That's one of the best I've ever seen. It's genetic. There should be other members of your family who have this heretofore unknown talent. You've got it. You've got it." He laughed again. "You're in a position to flash it at people. See, you should try that in a singles bar." Ekman then began to layer one action unit on top of another in order to compose the more complicated facial expressions that we generally recognize as emotions. Happiness, for instance, is essentially AU 6 and 12, contracting the muscles that raise the cheek, orbicularis oculi, pars orbitalis, in combination with the zygomatic major, which pulls up the corners of the lips.